So I took the liberty of changing the title a little bit. So my thought, and I'm not sure how this is going. I guess Emanuele gave sort of a more formal talk, covered a lot of material. My goal was to kind of give an overview of some of the things I'm thinking about and have done recently, just for those of you that don't know me, and maybe we can, I'm going to be around for a while. It'd be great to work together, come talk to me. So I just wanted to give you some flavor of the sorts of things I think about, and then I'll talk about some H-Knot stuff. All right, so that's the plan. So I'm just going to go through right now. It's just advertisements. It's like, you know, these sort of shotgun posters of a few recent projects, just to give you a sense. And a lot of them tie to various things that have been already discussed. So one is this issue of where the big black holes are. So this is some work I did with Maya a couple of years ago. And the point here, and it's still relevant, no matter what LIGO may or may not have seen, this is, you know, total mass. This is the sensitive volume. And the point here is that LIGO is what I really mean here is LIGO Virgo. The network is extremely sensitive to big black holes very far away. There's a lot of volume out there. You know, for most mass distributions, you would expect to see a lot of those, and we don't. And because we don't, you can show that there's this mass cutoff, and that's what we call the upper mass gap, and that, you know, it ties in very well with these ideas of parent stability supernovae. Okay, but the point here is, even if for some reason down the road there are some detections of some, you know, things potentially in the mass gap, there is still, we should see a lot, we don't. At best, it's some subpopulation. There definitely, there's no question there's evidence for some sort of cutoff. And that cutoff is remarkably well constrained, and we go into some of the reasons for that here. And, you know, as Emanuele mentioned yesterday, the cutoff now, I mean, this is sort of part of it. So this is now the plot from the latest LIGO analysis, and there are various ways to characterize what's happening here, but everything is consistent. The cutoff is somewhere around 40-ish. Okay. And that's not going to go away.
So what's the current number of detections of double black holes as of today?
Well, official sealed detection is 10.
So
the number of additional ones, I don't know, maybe it's, I mean, it depends what you call high significance. I think there's something like 6 or something like that. You can just go to GraceDB.
Like 20 more?
Well, no.
No.
So for any reasonable threshold, it's, you know, a handful. Maybe 10.
So 1 in 20.
So we've maybe doubled, right.
Okay, so 1 in 20 in the math lab, that's what you say. Okay.
Yeah, no comment. I will just make it very clear you should not believe all their rumors necessarily, and significance is a tricky thing.
Yes, of course.
Because we're very, LIGO is very responsive to the community, we release sub-threshold or low threshold.
Really? There's been a difference of opinion.
Yes, right. Apparently. Anyway, all those questions to Jocelyn. Where is Jocelyn? Jocelyn's not here. Any LIGO complaints to Jocelyn?
On the bike.
Okay. All right. So that's big black holes. Just an aside on spin. So this is a paper I did with Ben Farr and Will Farr. And this has been related to a lot of discussion. I think you've gone through this already, but this issue of how to infer spins, and here's one way to do it using symmetry properties of the distribution. But the main thing now is that I think this was the first time we actually had some sort of spin distribution, and now, you know, we're slowly improving those distributions. But you have to make, it's extremely prior dependent, and in this case, you know, if you assume the spins are aligned, then you know the spins are small, and that's not surprising. But if you allow them to be isotropic, they're very weakly constrained. They're probably still kind of not large. It's very hard to have all the spins be a delta function out here. But I mean, this was discussed yesterday. This is all, we have a long way to go there. Okay, Emanuele also discussed this. This is, you know, and Emanuele has a very similar paper to this, looking at, you know, how black holes are formed. I think the main message here, and it's been discussed by many people in this room, is that if you merge two black holes and they're anywhere near comparable mass, you end up with a black hole that's spinning. And there's no way to avoid that. It has to do with the orbital angular momentum. You just can't shed it. And so you can very cleanly make statements about whether the black holes in a black hole binary, the individual black holes, were themselves made out of smaller black holes by looking at spin, if only we had good measurements of spin. So it's a very good probe. And that's why there's a lot of excitement about that, one of the reasons. Okay, and one other thing we've done recently, this is work led by Maya Fischbach, was just looking at the evolution of the population. So we just ask, okay, we have some merger rate today. We're starting to see them farther back, the binary black holes. Is there evidence that there are more black holes merging earlier in the universe, which is what we would expect from most formation scenarios? When we first wrote the paper, we didn't have the full sample. Now with the full sample, so this is again from the latest LVC Astro paper, you're starting to see some evidence for evolution. It's very weak. No one should take this too seriously, but this is just with 10. It's, you know, very suggestive. It's kind of
where we're headed. It's weak. The blue line goes over order of magnitude.
Yeah, okay, so this is one sigma, but two sigma is still, you know, it can be consistent with flat.
Let's say if I just look at the blue line, but yes, more than order of magnitude over the redshift of 1. Star formation goes just order of magnitude over redshift 2.
Yeah.
So that's actually very steep.
Yes, it's steep, but you know, they're
big.
So you shouldn't, you know, I don't want your eye to be drawn just
to
the
line. Well, if you don't want me to look at
the line, don't draw it. Okay. I'll make a separate plot just for Chris.
I'm sorry,
that's okay.
I'm not attacking you, but I'm just.
But the point, and again, it's one of these things where you're getting some hints, and it's, okay, this is based on only 10. But the point is, you know, you look at them and there are, you know, a few more big ones that, like, this is what you end up with. But the errors are large.
And how much
only 10, this is going to collapse pretty quickly.
Yeah. So there is no secret that at least two of the Gandhian events in the.
Okay,
they are very far away.
Yes.
So is
that going to. So let me just also say it's no secret that, you know, the far away events are really not loud and really crappy, and maybe you shouldn't take them super seriously, but if they were real, then yeah, that's the sort of thing which starts to really impact us. I mean.
So what does it mean for us? Let's say it's steeper than the star formation.
Yeah, then so if it holds, yes, and if it even, yeah, then we have something very interesting, because you can't fix that with delays.
Like, look at the other curves, the red and the yellow.
Yeah, so these other are assuming no. So this is a rate estimate, and this assumes no evolution. So this is kind of what LIGO publishes. You know, the canonical rates are like here, but then if you allow for evolution, then the rate can be steep. And then what, you know, when you quote a rate, it's the rate today. And so we're just kind of showing where we are now compared to what happens. And part of the argument here is soon, even though we only have 10, we're on the cusp of needing to include evolution in the way we do this analysis, which is also shocking. I mean, it's just very, it's when you think, you know, a few years ago we had one and it was a big deal. Now we're really, it's what everyone says should happen. We're shifting into this population. Now we need to be much more sophisticated in the way we do the analysis. Yeah.
So in terms of the issue of significance, you're not going to have absolute certainty about any event. You'll have greater certainty for some than others.
Yes.
What do you do statistically in order to weight them to try to include the most information?
Yeah. So you can use, we have this P-Astro quantity, which I definitely don't want to get into now. Anyway, there are issues with it. But the idea is that that's a foreground, background probability. So if you know something about the population, then for any given event, you can say, is this likely to be part of that population or just noise? And you can incorporate those numbers in these sorts of analyses.
So do you effectively say the probability of this being an astronomical event is 99%, so we count it like 0.99 of an event?
Yeah. effectively, that's what you do, and then you just go through your Bayesian statistics. And so if you have an event which is only 20% likely, then it's downweighted. Now, up until recently, most events have been, you know, very close to one or very close to zero, and it's been, now we're kind of in this murky regime where, you know, some of the events are in between, and it's getting trickier, and the details of how you do Piastro start to be important.
So that also suggests that your understanding of the noise, which is evolving,
yes,
and therefore the value of Piastro for any event is evolving, and so there's going to be, right, presumably a sequence of reanalyses,
yes,
which will reweight these things.
And Piastro takes into account what we already know about the population. So as the population grows and we get a better sense of the mass distribution, Piastro is refined.
Okay.
All that being said, I should also, this is all based on very confident detections.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go a long way with confident detections. So one, you know, thing that is probably worth discussing, definitely not when I'm being recorded, is, you know, do we need all the sub-threshold stuff, which is pretty dicey? You know, these events that are right at the edge of our, you know, detection threshold to try to mess with this, because you can really screw yourself up if you're not careful, and it's very sensitive to how you define Piastro and the thresholds.
But so, don't forget, there's not going to be that many marginal events, because,
right,
the false alarm rate drops off very, very steeply as a function of signal strength, right? So the false alarm rate drops off 2 orders of magnitude for every half a unit of signal-to-noise ratio. So there's a very thin shell of marginal detections. You really need to go from confident detection to hidden in the noise. So the question is, how far do you want to dig in the noise? But you're not going to get a large number of, like, you're not going to get a significant number of you know, Piastro 50%. They're going to be small, or they're going to be large.
Okay, and you made the point a couple of weeks ago that the on the GraceDB page, the quoted false alarm rate is something that in many cases is
not
quite an upper limit on the true,
yes,
false alarm rate.
Yeah.
So that's misleading.
Yes.
Yeah, but it's also, I mean, so I think that is the way it's supposed to be. Like, it's, you know, as we reduce, it should, they should all go away. But the events that people are generally most excited about are precisely the ones that fall in this middle bucket. And, you know, I'm not sure if that's sociology or, anyway, that's again a longer conversation, but it's those events that are, for right now, those are the most massive, the most distant, you know, the ones that just have weird mass, whatever it is, those are the ones that get attention. But if they're real, then what happens is we'll have confident detections, because that's the nature. So we'll get high SNR, very low FAR, if they're part of the population. Because it's a population, they have to be there. And we'll get closer ones.
So how does this change the fold in the IAS detections?
So I don't think this changes very much, actually. We've done some analysis of the mass distributions, and those don't change very much. And I don't think this changes very much, but I haven't done it with, you know, all. So. Yeah, part of what makes this tricky is you have to understand your selection pretty well to do this. And so we should have a discussion of, you know, IAS selection, how to incorporate. Okay, some machine learning stuff, which I'll skip. But just to say, so, you know, we've done some work on machine learning. This was mostly for waveforms, but we're applying it also to kilonova light curves and equations of state and other things. So if that's something you're interested in, come talk to me. I've also done some work on just as more testing gravity, but just it's sort of related to the Hubble constant stuff. This idea that if you modify, one way to modify gravity is to add extra dimensions. If you add extra dimensions, then photons and gravitons, if that's your favorite language, don't see the same universe, and you can test that. And so we just wrote a paper where you can actually, I think it's kind of cool, you can actually infer the number of space-time, 3 plus 1, you know, would be canonical, space-time dimensions just from the observation of 170817, and you find that it's 4, which is reassuring. You know, but you might say, okay, I already knew that, but this is on, you know, megaparsec scales. It still would be very hard for there to be, but anyway, all that being said, this is a direct way to measure, and we say the universe has 3 plus 1 out to, you know, tens of megaparsecs.
Do events other than 170817 contribute significantly to this analysis?
We can only do this if we have light and gravitons. So right now it's just 170817. In the future, you can improve. The way to improve is if you get farther out. because then you just go to larger and larger scales.
So you're effectively reinterpreting the speed of light by measurements to see if stuff is leaking off.
It's more like a standard siren thing. So you can do the same thing with speed of light, but this is how bright and how loud they are.
So this is the amplitude rather than the arrival.
Exactly. So they fit together well. Yeah. Okay. I mentioned this on Monday, but just since we just put out this paper, this is a paper led by Sam Grala. It's just something I've also been thinking about recently. This is this point of black hole shadows and photon rings, which a lot of people have been talking about as of late. This was just trying to understand the EHT image, and people, there's this way of talking about it where they'll say, well, we've seen the black hole shadow. So you have to ask yourself, what is a black hole shadow? What does that mean? And there is a sort of definition of that. There are actually two. One is if you have a background screen, a lit screen, and you put a black hole in front, then you get a little cutout. There's an area where you just don't see anything, okay? Because the black hole, the photons coming, get absorbed by the black hole, but outside that, it's just uniform. Okay, so that's a clear shadow. If you have a circular screen, like the CMB, and you put a black hole and you look at it, you also see a shadow. Okay, so that's what people usually mean by black hole shadow. That is not at all what EHT is doing. EHT is seeing an accretion disk with light being emitted near the black hole. So you have to clarify what you're talking about. The way a shadow usually works is there's something called a photon ring, which is where photons are circling the black hole. So there's this kind of critical curve where as you get closer and closer, there's this point where photons start making one orbit, two orbits, three orbits, some large number of orbits. And at that point, it kind of rapidly goes to infinity, and that's a very distinct point. And inside that, you call it the black hole shadow. That's consistent with these other definitions. This photon ring is this, not this thicker curve. There's a tiny thin curve. I don't know, can people see it? There's a very thin curve here. That's the photon ring. Okay. This is for, it's model dependent. That photon ring is an image of the disk. All this light is the accretion disk. There's a black hole here. Here's the accretion disk. You image the entire disk into this photon ring. Okay. You're seeing the entire disk. There can be, in principle, a lot of light there, but it's highly demagnified. It's a very thin ring. Exponentially suppressed. This is not what EHT is seeing. They use words like photon ring. That's not really there. There's also this lensing ring, which is, this is the backside image of the disk. So if you're looking at a disk face on, which is sort of, very close to what M87 is in the EHT image, then the entire backside of the disk, so if there are photons here, instead of the photons coming out to your eye, they go back around the disk once, they come right here in this second ring, and to your eye, that's a little brighter. Okay, so maybe there's a lensing ring, but the really bright thing is this outer thing, which is properties of the inner edge of the accretion disk. So this is all a long-winded way to say, this paper was really just trying to clarify photon rings, black hole shadows, all this stuff. We kind of define them in a way that we think makes sense. And with this sort of definition, I don't want to detract from EHT in any way. It's amazing what they've done. But what we're, as far as I can tell, what we're really learning about is the accretion disk, the inner parts of the accretion disk, which is fascinating. Okay. Here's another paper from last month, I guess, with my picky partners. Yes?
So are you saying that the inner edge of the accretion disk extends well below 6 cm?
Right. So you can do it either way.
Because their measurement claims that that's at 10.4, which is consistent with this one of the three.
Yeah. So the question, so at the end, so if you really want to know what you see around a black hole, you have to describe the accretion disk. You can chop the accretion disk at the ISCO. You can assume it goes all the way in, all the way right into the horizon and keep going. And then you get slightly different images. But the details depend somewhat sensitively on how you do that. So we go through a number of examples in the paper. No matter what you do, this photon ring, it never plays a role.
So what size do they measure from the image?
What size for the black hole? You mean like in microarc seconds or?
You're measuring some feature.
Yes.
Which you measure its size in microarc
seconds. So all they measure.
What is that feature?
So they measure one ring, and it's, you know, it's asymmetric due to, we think, Doppler boosting. And so that's just a ring. Now, if you identify it with this photon ring, then you infer mass. You can play this whole game. If you then identify it with a lensing ring, you get a different mass. It's like 5 or 10% shifted. If you identify with the accretion disk, that depends a lot on properties of the accretion disk, exactly what the accretion disk is doing and how far down it goes.
The way that I interpret this, they're not measuring rings or disks. They're measuring the whole piece there. That's very blurry.
Yes, and
so all
and
that
in
the image.
Yes.
And I think when they, there are various ways in which you try to estimate what the mass of the black hole is, and in some of their ways they actually do look at accretion disk simulations.
Yes.
There.
Right, and in fact, that's the right. And so, just okay. So since so what they really measure is the UV plane. So right, their image is interferometric, right? So it's in this, Fourier plane, if you like, and then they infer based on images, analysis of simulations, what these images might look like. That constrains your problem enough that you can generate an actual image. And they do that, but it's very sensitive to the simulations. And then what they do is they have a suite of simulations. And to be clear, they don't go into the simulations and say, this is a photon ring, this is a black hole shadow. They just have some image, they compare it to what they've inferred, and then they say, what were the parameters of the simulation? Here was, here's how we scale the mass of the black hole. And so all the actual measurements are consistent so long as the simulations have spanned enough of the space.
None of the simulations actually, in a formal sense, fit the data very well. But this is understandable because of a lot of time variation. So they have the best they can do is actually formally not a good fit.
Right. And it's they only have a few UV tracks, and they're inferring an entire image.
That's an ill-defined inversion problem.
Yes.
And they have various pipelines that try to do the inversion different ways.
Yes.
Even with the same simulation, they get different results. Like the famous image that they published is a superposition of their
problem. Yeah. So there's a lot of sausage in there.
Yeah.
But the main thing I want to say is no matter what is going on in terms of black hole shadows and photon rings, which I think was a big part of what was being claimed, that's very, I would claim, questionable. You have to be very careful about your language.
So there was this claim that, there's two different mass determinations from the gas dynamic versus stellar.
Yes.
Their results seem to be consistent with the stellar. Is that threatened by
So that is very sensitive, again, to these simulations and the way you do this process. And so right now there's not that much information about the suite of simulations and what parameters were used and how did they really go through it and, how much freedom do they have in the accretion disk physics to really encapsulate all possibilities? So that's a question for that. Now, what they have not done is just taken that image, measured across, the photon ring is analytic, and just, here's my estimate of mass. If you do that, it's totally wrong. I think people have had a tendency to just do that in talks, because it's a very easy way to think about it. You don't want to do that. The photon ring is not relevant here in this discussion. Same with the black hole shadow.
And concerning the spin, do they see some Peterson effect?
So this stuff now that's a higher order thing, and again, it's in the simulations, and that they definitely don't have an ability to constrain that yet. Like you could hope to see squashing and various, we're not there yet.
That's a good point, because I think there's a question could the accretion disk be tilted?
Yes.
And they haven't done, as far as I know, most of their simulations, so they said they've done a suite of 60,000 simulations,
right.
They all essentially mean equatorial.
Yeah.
So So there's a lot of caveats.
Yes, so there's a lot. So it's one of these, and it's something, I mean, just for the, I mean, people used to complain with LIGO, oh, you know, you put in GR to do your template matching, and then you get out GR and you say, look, it matches. But that's totally legit, and we can talk about that, it's fine. In this case, they've put in some reduced suite of simulations, which are very difficult simulations, and their answers are, everything in terms of actual physics answers are very dependent on that set. And so, I don't want to, like, this is, it's amazing, like, the image is amazing, right? I mean, we're talking 20 micro, I mean, it's just, the numbers are blow your mind, so that's fantastic. Just, we don't want to get too excited yet about what we've actually imaged and have we shown that's a black hole. They're talking about testing relativity. That's completely insane right now.
Yeah. Well, since we're on the subject, they are also hoping for being able to put out papers related to the analysis of the polarization data, which they have not yet done.
No.
What can we expect, given the tremendous difficulty and uncertainty related to the simulations, which will no doubt also have to be applied to polarization?
Yes.
Will there be substantial enough ambiguities or lack of coverage that we should not expect really major advances, or are there things you can be robust about?
So I would be surprised, at the level even of this, it's already quite difficult to make robust statements, mm-hmm. Just because we don't understand. I mean, the simulations are just too involved. So you need some very robust feature, which probably would have to do with properties, you know, further out. I mean, we can. So right now, I think it's. I mean, for example, the next big thing will be Sajay Star, which then is edge on. This is all face on.
Yeah.
That introduces its own complications. There, the real problem is the time scale. It's much shorter, so their UV tracks are now much less useful. So now it's even more, you know, there's a lot of black box stuff going on in there to get an image out because you're not taking simulations and averaging them over time, over many dynamical times. There's a lot of work. So my guess is it's going to be a while before we're learning, you know, anyway.
I mean, the hope for some people is that if you have one of these mad disks where you actually have strong, coherent, basically Z-facing magnetic fields, that
yes.
there would be clear polarization structures.
Right. Yeah. I think we're a ways from having measurements of the polarization, given that, because you need high significance polarization detection.
Yeah.
Right? And this is, we're marginal even combining both at this point. So. But for the future, I mean, if they get enough time, they can really improve this. Mm-hmm. So, okay. Emanuele actually discussed this at some length yesterday, so I'm just going to skip this. But, you know, I'm definitely interested in making black hole binaries. Okay, so that was the kind of, some of the things I'm interested in. You know, come talk to me if you want to hear more about that. And now I will do as I was told and talk about... Hubble constant. Okay. So here we go. I'm going to start with some stuff about standard sirens, and then I'll kind of pull out and talk about the Hubble constant. So the main point of standard sirens, I assume everyone's kind of familiar with the basic idea. The main thing I want to emphasize, the calibration. So this is a way to measure distance out to cosmological scales. The main thing here is that the calibration is provided by general relativity. If you believe the theory of general relativity, it tells you that the distance, absolute distance, no distance ladder, none of the crap that usually goes with astrophysics. It's just that's how far it is. It's like a direct geometric distance. To do this in the standard way, you need redshift. You need an independent measurement of redshift. We can talk about why that is. Or, as Jocelyn's pointed out, if you believe the equation is state, or you have other, if you know the mass distribution, if there are other things you can do, you can actually do a better job without having independent redshift. And there's a lot of interesting stuff, I think, going forward on that, and I'll talk about that briefly in a bit. But the vanilla way of doing this is GR gives you a distance. If you get some redshift independently, now you have what you need to do cosmology. And it's this very complicated formula, V equals HD. Okay, this is, I mean, when we do the analysis, okay, it's really, you're using the Hubble parameter and you do all this correctly, but nearby, you need a velocity, you need a distance, you infer H naught. The distance comes directly from the binaries, from GR. The velocity is the redshift from EM. You infer H naught. It's very straightforward. Okay, so who cares? So the reason this is an issue and is something that's being discussed at length at the moment is there are many different ways to show this, and I'll show a number of plots, but it really comes down to this sort of plot, which is, was done by Wendy Friedman, just to kind of dramatize what's going on. So here there are really two ways to measure this. One is kind of CMB-oriented measurements, which are kind of the reddish thing, and the other is nearby supernova-based measurements, which are the blue things. Okay? And it used to be, quite uncertain, right? This is the Hubble Key Project, which made the definitive measurement. It was a huge big deal when it came out. There's their measurement, which was thought to be really great. It ruled out 30, 40, 50, which that was a major advance at the time. And now it's gone better and better and better. And, this is roughly speaking the latest value. And here is where CMB has ended up. And they're not the same. And so this is what people call tension. Okay, and I'll talk a little more about this as we go along. But this is why people care. Okay, it's not that we really fundamentally need to know the value of the Hubble constant because we all care about the age of the universe to 2%. It relates to other things, and it has to work. Yeah.
Last time I was familiar, I became familiar with this. The discrepancy was 3 sigma. Now you say that it's greater than 4 sigma. Is there some reason?
Yeah. So I'll show that. Yeah. Okay. So I'm just going to go through. I'll go through the two. There's sort of CMB, and then there's supernovae. CMB is early universe, supernovae and late universe. And so here's more or less how it works. So first, there's Planck. Okay, this plot, this is this is why we have precision cosmology. These points have error bars. The error bars, you can't even see them. Like, it goes way out. This blue curve is theory. So we kind of know what's going on. There are some details which I won't go into, but Planck does not actually measure, like the primary CMB, what you usually hear about CMB, does not measure the Hubble constant. Right? It's that the Hubble constant gives an overall scale which you don't know. So just from primary CMB, you don't measure the Hubble constant, but if you take the whole thing, then you get a measurement of the Hubble constant, and that's what they do. Okay. When you do that, this is what you get, and it's exquisite. The data is so exquisite. So this is their latest result, and this is at a percent level. All right, so that is quite solid. Okay. Now, I'll leave it at that. I can talk more about CMB in a bit, but in principle, it looks really good.
Are the projects also for the error bar?
I think it's hard to go much beyond this, just because there's one sky, and then it has really to do with these higher order modes and the lensing maps, and the polarization can help, but there's some issues there, and so I don't think it's going to get dramatically better. Okay, all right. So that's one side. The other side is supernovae. There are a few other things, but supernovae are kind of the canonical best example. And so these are type 1a standard candles, and I'm sure everyone's familiar with the whole story of these were used to measure the acceleration of the universe. That was very exciting, Nobel Prizes, all the rest. So for all those measurements, you couldn't use those supernovae to measure the Hubble constant. Because for those measurements, what you're looking at is you just assume that they're a standard candle. You don't actually need to know the absolute normalization of the standard candle. You just notice that the distances are falling off, and that must be due to the universe accelerating, and you don't actually need to know the absolute. Anyway, it's a minor thing, but for most of this stuff that was done, You only need to know relative brightness. As long as they're a standard channel, you don't need to actually standardize them in terms of absolute luminosity. But if you want to know the Hubble constant, you do. So if you want to get the Hubble constant, now you have to know exactly how many photons came out of that supernova. And so there's this process. This is a distance ladder where you use geometry, that means parallax, to measure distances. You get out to, say, the LMC. You get a bunch of Cepheids. Now you've normalized the Cepheids. You use those to go out. You find galaxies where you have Cepheids and type 1As. Then you normalize the type 1As, and then you can go all the way up. So there are a bunch of steps. Each of these steps can make you nervous, but they have hammered away at this stuff. They've done it in different ways. They've taken subclasses. There's an incredible amount of work here. Okay. And as a result of all that, here's the latest. And so this is the point. This is, I guess it came out in March. May, came out in May. OK, so they're now claiming they're at the level of approaching 1%. Okay, so it's just been getting better. So what's been happening is not things haven't been moving per se, but the error bars, especially on the supernovae, have been shrinking. And so now, I think this is like roughly a 2% measurement, and it's high. It's been moving slightly higher.
There's also the time delay measurements for very small lengths.
Yes. Right.
Better and now we think
they've reached the same precision. Yes. Right. Although I don't know if the value is coming out again next week. That's right. And there's also the tip of the red giant. There are all these other ways to do it. All of them, this now is in the land of systematics, I would claim. So having just, a solid statistical measurement is not enough. You really have to understand the systematics. So this is me now, editorial comment. Strong lensing is really hard, understanding the systematics. That, again, this is just me. I mean, people would argue this, but you're trying to understand the lens. It's very, dependent on the lens. It's amazing the progress that's been made, but there's a ways to go, I think, there. But nonetheless, it kind of fits in with this high value, which is suggestive. Okay. No, this is one sigma, I think. Yeah, it probably says somewhere in the abstract, but in general, in this community, it's always one sigma. So here is sort of a more recent plot that summarizes this with lots of data points, and. Again, your eye is supposed to be drawn to the blue versus red, separation, and this is where this 4.4 sigma comes from. Okay. So, you can decide how. So this is using this latest 2% measurement from Riesedel. Okay, but there are lots, and here's the lensing, the strong lensing result is here. So, okay, it's suggestive. These are all high redshift, these are all low redshift. So the way it's normally phrased is, maybe something weird happens between CMB and today, and that would be incredibly exciting, and you can start messing with the standard model to try to account for this. So that would be great. And so that, there's,
When you show the measurements, the sequence of measurements from CMB.
Yes.
To understand it, it's all in the error bars, but there was like a transition between WMAP and Planck.
Yes.
Did they discuss that?
So there are a number, and so there is, so CMB is not quite as clean as it, as it first appears. Like, I mean, it really fits the data, but then the E-mode stuff, there's some slightly weird things, and so getting to the bottom of the polarization is tricky. It's also normalization is tricky on these. So it used to be, for example, that COBE was used to normalize the dipole, which is an important part of it. So it's taken a while to really get to the bottom of this to, get to solid results. So what I would say now is, this has really been poured over. It's quite robust, but there are a few things that just don't look quite right. So maybe there's some potential systematics there. I don't know. I mean, that's, so that's, but this is where George Lasasu will come in and decapitate me. So I have to be very, you know, careful.
All right, so I don't want George to decapitate you, but I do want to follow up on Alberto's question. So one of the things I've at least heard is that if you look at the source of the difference between Planck and supernova 1A or Planck and WMAP to a degree, that it is largely concentrated in the high L modes.
Yeah.
Now, at that level, is it reasonable to suspect that there might be secondary contributions, lensing from large-scale structure, for example, that could alter that in a way that hasn't been properly taken into account?
Yeah, I mean, it's, so now you also have sort of SPT points at even higher L, and you can match them. And so there's a lot of work there trying to understand how all this stuff fits together. So I think at first you could make an argument, you know, maybe we're missing something along the way. I think it's harder to do that now, is my impression, because people have tied SPT down to the Planck results. And my understanding is things more or less work. But I don't know for sure, and I don't want to get myself into trouble and say something that ends up not
okay. Right. And then the second follow-up, which maybe you're going to discuss, is that, as you say, the classic thing, even if you're looking for new physics, is you've got high redshift, low redshift, something funny is happening along the way. But one of the things you indicate is more or less agreeing with the CMB is baryon acoustic oscillation.
Yes, very good. So that's exactly my next point. Okay, so so it's exactly this point Cole raised, which is there's this other way to measure distances, baryon acoustic oscillations, where you're taking kind of the CMB scale, you run it through just gravity, and then you get scales of clustering of galaxies, and you can use that to do measurements. And those measurements are redshift of a half to, you know, I mean, low, what we would consider low universe. Okay. So those measurements now, so this is what's called the inverse distance ladder. So the point here is the Hubble constant, of course, is not constant. And so you have the value today, but it's really the Hubble parameter. And as you go early in the universe, it changes. And so if you measure this at any point in the early universe, you can now run it forward to today and say, what is the value here? What would it correspond to in terms of H naught today? Okay. And so what I'm showing here are these gray bands, which you can barely see, is the CMB. So this is now redshift of 1100. You've taken the CMB, you're shooting it all the way forward, and you end up here at 67. Okay. So, and that's their claimed error. All right, here's the supernova measurement today. That's their claimed error, and this is the 4 sigma. Okay. Now, BAO is a different thing. Now you're using galaxy clustering. It's happening at redshift of a half, and it agrees with the CMB. Okay, so if you want to account for...
Wait. What does it mean it agrees with the CMB? I mean, there are 3 points.
Yeah, okay. You have this, you have this, you have that. But, you know, this kind of shifts. So, you know, is it going to be consistent with this hitting here?
I'm sure you can.
It's pretty hard. Statistically speaking, it's pretty hard. So there, you know, well, you can see, I mean, when you actually go through this, okay, this is what you get for the BAO type measurements. Okay, you know, maybe it's not the end of the world. It's not as narrow as Planck, but it's they don't like the high values of H naught. Okay.
Just for some history, you said the first time scale that they used to be able to debate is a higher level.
Yes.
Some people think there are 50.
Right.
So what was wrong with the 50 measurements, do you remember?
I think were those coming, so that was it Sandage?
Yeah.
And it was supernovae, is that right? And
no, I don't remember.
All the distance ladders.
Yeah.
Many issues.
But what was the main, like, Cepheids. Way they were measuring? It was Cepheids, but then... Yeah. So I think it was all in the details of the distance ladder, which is, I mean, I think is probably my main point, which is at the end of the day. So let me just finish on BAO and I'll get back to this. So
So BAO still uses a cosmological model?
So BAO is slightly tricky. So it uses a cosmological model, and it's sourced by the CMB. You take the CMB power spectrum, that gives you the scale, which you then push forward. So it's not totally independent, but you know, the point is it's consistent. If it's consistent and you want to account for this with physics, you don't have any room, really. Like, it's not, you can think, oh, I'm just going to change H of Z, I'll, you know, the dark energy is going to have some funny property at redshift 5, and I'm just going to have it change, there's a phase transition, you know, anything a theorist might like, and I can account for this discrepancy. And that will not work. So my claim is, given where we are now, if you believe this is real, these measurements are real, and this is real, and you will now want to fix it up with physics, it's you have to be really extraordinarily creative. And really what you need is a bunch of miracles, because you need to shift the CMB in such a way that it looks perfect, but it's just shifted just the right amount to account for the super. I mean, it's really contorted and unpleasant. So I think, as a hint of new physics, this is really hard. Anyway, that's, again, an editorial comment, but I think there's been, I hadn't realized until recently just how difficult it is to account for this. So given the choice between new physics, which is really extreme, or we've already screwed up this, and we have a good, a very, you know, extensive history of screwing up the distance ladder, you know, it's very easy to say, well, there's probably something in the distance ladder. But, you know, then I have Adam Riess coming in and trying to decapitate me. So, you know, and there are a lot of, you know, steps in there which they've really poured over. I mean, it's amazing how much effort and how careful they've been. So it's really an issue. And we need, it needs so to be resolved.
So are those efforts being all documented, like they mention all of those details in their paper?
Yeah, so they're very good, and they go through the kind of, here's the different systematic checks we've done, and they have three different ways to calibrate the distance ladder, and it's impressive. So I think it's good, if there is a systematic, it's not just, oh, they forgot to, you know, have some reddening factor here, and now it's all, that it's going to have to be some very subtle thing that comes in many different ways. It's an incredible amount of work has gone into this, so it's pretty robust. But it just can't, from a theory perspective, it can't be right. So something's amiss. So I'll just point out, in a couple of weeks, there's actually a whole, there's going to be a short conference here on this topic. You know, Adam will be here, and, you know, Sylvia Galli is representing Planck, and Wendy Freeman will be here. Hopefully she'll have new results to talk about with the, you know. Anyway, so it's all going to be what the hell's going on. So if you're still around, this is, I guess, July 15th to 17th. It should be fun. Okay, so what time is it? Actually, I have a little
10:20.
Okay. I told myself I would end well before 11. All right. So that was all motivation. Okay. So fine. You should be interested in H-naught. If only you had a really good way, clean way to measure H-naught in the local universe, that would be awesome. No distance ladder. None of that stuff. Just so. That's what standard sirens offer you. there are really two ways to do standard siren measurements. One is if you have a counterpart and you measure the redshift directly from the counterpart, and the other is statistical. And so I'm going to just talk about each of those in turn. Okay, so I'll start with the counterpart case. Needless to say, 170817 was just, it was a gift. Like, if you're interested in this stuff, you just can't believe that nature is so kind as to provide 170817. It's a perfect standard siren. And so you can use it. You can use it to do this counterpart method. And here's the best plot ever. So this is H-naught as measured from 170817. The green is Planck. The red is the supernova. This is now shrunk somewhat and is now over really centered on 74. It gives you a sense of where we want to be, and blue is the measurement from 1708-17, which has huge error bars, 10-15%, right? But it's one event. It's the very first time it's been done. One event, and it could have been anywhere, but physics works, and it's more or less in the right place. It's also, I will just draw your eye, it's quite non-Gaussian. Right, there's this tail. This has to do with the distance inclination degeneracy. In fact, I think I have a plot. So there's this distance inclination degeneracy. So you can trade off distance and inclination. Here, distance is H naught is my proxy for distance, inclination, and depending on what inclination you like, you can kind of see how, where this degeneracy comes in and why you get this long tail. Okay, and so this is what's been done so far, and going forward, we can improve it. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. All right, so there's also a statistical approach. So so this is a paper which Amaya and I led, which was to do the exact same thing. So take 1708-17 now, but now do the statistical approach. So we pretend we didn't see NGC-4993. We have no idea what galaxy it is. Okay. So now what you do is you say, well, I have some localization volume. I'm going to look at every galaxy in that localization volume. Each of those is a potential host. Each of those gives me a redshift. I can marginalize over all those redshifts, and I get a measurement of my of H0. And there are a lot of steps along the way, because now what do you mean by a galaxy, and do you have to have some threshold, and do you have a complete catalog, and are you going to weight by, is the BNS more likely to follow star formation or stellar mass? Like, there are all these games you can play. They change your results a little bit. At the end of the day, here are the sorts of measurements you get. So again, this is H0. Notice it's now going from 0 to 200. But you do get a constraint. It's a surprisingly good constraint. It's more or less in the right place. The pink curve here is the canonical, assuming the counterpart statistical measurement, counterpart measurement. And so, these are wider, but in the right place. This is an extremely long-winded way to say, if you look in the volume for, 1708-17, there's actually one group of galaxies which dominates in that volume, and NGC-4993 is in that group. And so, if it's a small enough volume, because there's large-scale structure, you're going to get the right answer over time. Okay, so that sounds encouraging, because yes, there is large-scale structure. It's the galaxies really are clustered, so maybe this is going to work well, especially for, say, binary black holes, where you don't expect to have a counterpart, but you see a lot of those. We see a lot more of those than BNSs, and we see them much farther out into the Hubble flow. Maybe that would be a great.
Do you have maps of galaxies to be found?
Right. So let me give you one example of how this works. Okay, very subtle change. Did anyone see it? It's now 0814, not 0817. We play the same game with 0814 now. For that, it turns out you need a galaxy catalog, it's farther away. This was, again, so there are a lot of minor miracles in the way that all this stuff plays out. This was the first triple, so this was the first one where Virgo contributed and helped us really refine the localization. And so for a BBH, it's an unusually small localization volume, so now we can play the same game. And it turns out it's in the middle of the DES footprint. So the DES catalog, which is sort of the best galaxy catalog we have now, deepest, it comes for free. So we use the DES. So this is a paper that was done between LIGO and DES. We use the DES galaxy catalog, and we just do the same thing. We ended up with on the order of 80,000 galaxies in the localization volume, compared to 100 when we did the statistical 1708-17. So it's and this is a really good situation.
When you talk about localization volume, and what probability level?
90%. If you go to 99, the volume really gets large. So there are a ton of subtleties, which I won't go into. There are lots of issues here. This is what you get. Okay? This is our 170817 standard siren. And this is CMB and Planck. And here is what we ended up with. Okay?
Then it's, in both clause, there's a set on lower.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So in this case, this is just to do, doing, has to do with structure in that volume. So there's just some other group of galaxies.
And what about the case of GW17, 117, one of the three laws, no, the previous.
Oh, in the statistical one? Right. Yeah, it must be the same thing that there, that there's a.
The green.
Yeah, curve. Okay, yeah. So this is, okay, so Sloan gives you a galaxy catalog, I mean, or DES gives you a galaxy catalog, which is great. You need to know redshifts. Right, that's the whole point. So DES doesn't do it's not spectroscopic, right? So DES has colors, and you turn them into redshifts. And there's been a lot of work to do that, which is great. Most of that work is for lensing, for weak lensing measurements. And so they've calibrated, it works extremely well to the level they need. The lensing kernel is actually quite broad, so you don't need it that accurate. And it's all at higher redshift. We're now taking these redshifts, but we're doing it for galaxies at low redshift. And there's some issues. I'll just leave it at that. So you get features in the galaxy distribution which aren't real and have to do with where the colors, you know, end, and you know, that causes where the line, when the line jumps across one of your filters, you get a feature. Okay.
Is it also due to the fact that the galaxies have their own motion, which is not?
Yeah, so there's some peculiar velocity, but this is much higher out. This is hundreds of megaparsecs, so peculiar velocity is very subdominant. So for 0817, you can worry about that for BNSs, but for BBHs, it's basically irrelevant.
Just saying that there's the bump for an intermediate velocity cutoff.
Yeah, but again, it has a lot to do with exactly how this selection is done. So when you get to very low, now you just have lots and lots, right? I mean, the mass function of galaxies goes up pretty dramatically. Okay. All right. So on this, I would claim. I mean, there are a lot of issues with making this plot because you have to make a lot of selections. There's issues of how you do the redshifts and how well you. So one thing that's done here is you artificially inflate the redshifts just to smooth away the features that are in the photo Z pipelines. This is hard. This is a best case type of BBH. It's in the DES footprint. We have a wonderful galaxy catalog. It's relatively nearby. It has a very small volume comparatively. This is the sort of measurement we do. So this kind of hints at where we might hope to go with the statistical method. Okay, so here is, I only have a couple more plots. So this is a paper with Xinyu Chen and Maya Fischbach where we just kind of went through this and asked, how will we do in the future? We have these two methods, counterpart statistical. Let's just make some basic assumptions and get a rough sense of where we're headed. Okay? And so what I'm plotting here, this is roughly speaking year. I mean, not linear. They're just we picked a few years, and this is, you know, corresponding to what we think the network will be at and how well we'll measure H naught. And I'll just point out that. Roughly speaking, 2022, you know, which should be the end of 1 year design sensitivity, we're at a couple of percent, 2.5%. With large, this assumes every BNS has a counterpart. There's large uncertainties in the rates, so it could be, you know, 8%, or it could be, you know, approaching 1%.
How many BNS?
I think, well, maybe I have that in the next plot, something like 30.
So judging from what we were much closer to the cool stars.
So right now, we have a maybe 10% measurement, right? we're over here, and we're already like in here somewhere. Okay. But it doesn't, you know, that's with one. So for O3, if we got a couple more, maybe we start to come down below 10%.
Without the counterpart, or the 17 or 17 still dominate?
17 or 8. So one thing which is should be clear is, and this is, we've used that as a prior. This was written after 0817. 0817 was very unusual, and we did a very good measurement of H0 with it. And statistically speaking, you know, that's like a 1 in 30 event. And so, in principle, it will take a while for us, you know, just statistically, if we did this purely statistically, you know, all right, we'd have some large uncertainty, and 0817 would be right at the bottom of that. And so we use that as a prior. And another thing that's going on here is this non-Gaussianity. So you're in your head, you're probably saying, well, 0817 was really good, but okay, it wasn't that great, it's only like 10%, and now, you know, how long is it going to take me to get to a percent? I'm going to need like a 100 of those, and that's, you know, good luck. But it's non-Gaussian, so you actually converge much faster. The point is there are these tails, and if you get one which has a tail going the other way, the two of them combine to make a pretty narrow peak. And so that's part of what creates this rapid convergence. And then once you get into kind of the Gaussian regime, then it slows down. Okay. So
how much does the gamma ray burst help with the inclination angle?
So for this, I'm ignoring all other measurements of inclination. This is pure gravity. Okay. So you can also play this game by saying, oh, you know, I've got gamma ray measurements, or, you know, I've noticed the radio, transluminal, blah, blah, I can now do a much better job of inclination. Okay, then that improves this significantly. You know, maybe it's, you know, 50% improvement in errors. It depends exactly how well you've measured inclination. So now this is, again, just my personal view is, that's a dicey business because now you're introducing a bunch of potential astrophysical systematics. How well do you really measure your inclination? Are you sure you've done it right? We've done it. Like you might as well do it and see what happens. But for all this, it's just pure gravity. Because the goal here is to come up, if we have a 1% measurement, we want to be able to put it on that plot with CMB and supernovae and say, this is a very clean measurement. We don't want them to come back and say, yeah, but if I use this different inclination model, I can shift it by 5%. Okay. So, but there's no question people will do that because you get a better measurement, at least in the short term.
Do things improve if you actually do a statistical analysis that involves all of these different classes?
Yeah. So let me get to the statistical analysis. So this is just BNSs, assuming they all have counterparts. BBHs now, you have a lot more of them. They're farther out. You know, maybe that's the way to go. So this is kind of estimates of the statistical approach with BBHs and with BNSs. So let's assume we have BNSs, but we can't find the counterparts. Okay? All right. So, I mean, we already have one trigger in 003 where no one has announced the counterpart. So if that's a BNS, that's an example of this. The best we could do in that case is statistical. In that case, it's a quarter of the sky, so good luck. But maybe down the road, we'll have a bunch of BNSs that have small localization volumes. Here's how well we expect you would do.
What's the assumption for localization volumes here?
So we just did, you know, we calculated them at Monte Carlo. So we took the noise curve, we, you know, populated a universe, we did detections, ran through SNR of 8 in 1-1. So
glass half empty, if I look at this plot, do I interpret correctly that even with, you know, another 6 or 7 years of deviation detections, I've still not met by 17 or 17?
Yes.
The top of that green bar is level.
Yeah.
With
so,
that.
Oh,
the top
so
of the
I should say.
Now is level with the,
so the BNS thing assumes 0817.
Right.
This assumes no counterparts. So this is just pure statistical.
Yes. Yeah, so if I ignore all the BBHs.
Yes. Yes.
Right. Then I still have the same knowledge. Or if I added in all the BBHs, I still have basically the same knowledge I have today.
Yeah.
Right, because it gets down to 10% with 7 years of deviation statistical measurements.
That's correct.
So what are the...
So just that, because I think Duncan's making an important point. So the statistical case, you know, it's great because it now you don't even have to see the counterpart. You can just use the BBHs. But it's very wide because they say the universe has too many galaxies. And so it converges very slowly, and it's unlikely to contribute a really interesting measurement in the near future.
You can argue still with doing because you seem to be further away.
Yeah, so you're probing further into the flow, and maybe you get, you know, W information maybe, but, you know, if you have a good measurement of H0 plus CMB, you've got really good constraints on at least part of the equation is there. Yeah.
So first, what are the error bars on the star points? I
mean, yeah.
Are as big as the green one?
Yeah, they're as big. I mean, it's a little small. A lot of this is the rate uncertainty, and the rate uncertainty on the BBHs is a little smaller. But to do this, you also need to know the mass distribution and exactly where it cuts off. And so roughly speaking, it's you know, maybe a little, maybe half of what you see here.
And the other question is whether on those statistical measurements, did you look a little bit in the contribution of those single events? Because we tried to play this game a few times with the Emerys, for example, for Lisa, right? And even if you get, you know, 200 events, the end, there are six or seven that strain all
the time. Right. So exactly to that point. So what we're actually doing here is it turns out the vast majority of these events are useless.
Yeah.
The sky localization is just too large, the volume is too large, there are just too many galaxies. You have no, it's completely uninformative. So I think this is, I forget what, maybe 10,000 square degrees. There's some volume that we use as a minimum cutoff. And that cuts your population. I think it's a few percent of the total population.
I mean, you see this when people do these, like, you know, what happens to the population? You see this all the time. It's the next significant event that improves.
Yes.
So my guess is the big drop between 19 and 22 is there's a probability you'll get another 17 to 817 like event.
Yeah, that's right. At some point you end up, and it's just, you know. And so most of these, if you look at, I have some plots somewhere I can dig up. But if you actually, you know, each, this is all based on, I should say, you know, thousands upon thousands of actual Monte Carlos where we do the measurements, how well do you get, you know, distance, how well do you get H0, and combining them all, and it's always you get this, and then there's a drop. And then that's just because suddenly you get a good event. And so 17.0817 was a great event. If they were all like that, you know, would be done, you know, in a year, but, yeah.
If there's a really sharp mass cutoff in the binary black holes.
Yes.
Can you see the redshifted Chert mass and get the redshift back?
Yes. Yeah, that's a paper I'm working on with Maya and Wilfar. It's quite interesting. So we should have results on that pretty soon. But it's an excellent point. So any feature in the distribution lets you do cosmology. Okay. Here is just another version of this, but now you have the numbers. I forget, someone was asking about numbers. So this is kind of, you can also, this is a projection of the number of BNSs we would expect in the different.
Is it assuming that every line?
Yes, this assumes that every single one has a counterpart. So if you say, you know, for some reason.
One in ten.
One in ten. Okay, then you know. You divide by 10 and you go to the appropriate.
But it doesn't necessarily matter that everyone has a counterpart. It matters the most significant.
Yes, right. Which might be, for example, face on.
Right.
Which are more likely if you have some.
If you dominate by that loud event, so as long as that loud event has a counterpart, it doesn't matter if the others don't.
That's right.
But then what are the odds that we get another one that 40 megabytes?
That you can do Poisson statistics on them.
No, that's just a volume thing. So it is true. I mean, one thing to keep in mind is what part of what is happening here is we get more sensitive. This is particularly relevant for the BBHs. It's great. We're more sensitive. Most of the population that we're getting are farther away, which don't help as much. Okay. So the BBHs, a lot of the, you know, the additional BBHs aren't great. But then if we get 17.0814 in the advanced era, it'll be incredibly loud. And we'll do a much better measurement. But we have to wait for those. Okay. And all of this is based on the detection rate. Oh, one other thing, just you know, full disclosure. Okay. What's great about this is it's calibrated by general relativity.
The fact that you'll see it's going to be much louder, but the sky localization is not going to be that much better than 70 minutes.
It'll be a little better, and the distance will be a little better. Everything improves a little bit. But yes, it's not you know, a sea change. Okay, so the main point of all this is that there are essentially no systematics, at least in terms of the population. Like, we understand GR, right? We know what BBH is, and BNS is what the waveform should look like. We get the distances very well. So you can ask, you know, what's the catch? And the catch is there are still systematics having to do with the instrument. Okay? Like, we are measuring how loud the binary is, and if we don't get that to a percent, then we don't get the distance to a percent. So we have to have calibrated the detectors to this level. And there's a lot to talk about in terms of calibration. And there's been a lot of effort recently of trying to improve the way the calibration is done. So this is a very, you know, long topic, but I would say I'm going to summarize that topic to say we think you know, LIGO, Virgo will get to the percent level by the time it's relevant. And we're probably already at a few percent. And there, we can talk a lot about the way the calibration is done. I'll also just advertise another paper I put out recently with Reed Essick, who's a postdoc at Chicago, where we did the following thing. I just thought it was kind of cute. It's we took 1708-17. The waveform is predicted by GR. So you have this beautiful waveform. You can now take that waveform, and you can use it to calibrate the detector. And we have a measure of distance. We can use the Hubble crossing if you believe CMB or supernovae. So you can now predict uniquely the strain that you should detect. So it's turning it around, not using it as a standard siren, but using GR to constrain properties of the detector itself. So you can do a frequency-dependent calibration of the detector based on a source. You can think of it as you now have a, you know, standard source out there that you're using to calibrate the detector, and we actually ran through and calibrated the detector using 1708-17. The calibration's not that great, it's like 20 or 30%, but we're using an astronomical source to calibrate a gravitational wave detector, which 3 years ago would have been completely inconceivable, and now it's being done, which gives you a sense of how rapidly the community is moving. Anyway, I thought that was kind of
so. In terms of your last blue point, then, the galaxy misidentification, if we go to the statistical approach,
yes.
So you don't have direct counterpart, and you're using the 90% solid angle of
yes.
What you're looking at, so that means you're going to get the wrong thing. You're going to be the wrong volume for 10% of your detections. How much does that mess up with your final analysis?
Yeah. So. The trick here, so I'm going to answer it in the way I like, which is this is all about systematics. So what, so if you have something where you get, you know, you're off, there's some other population of galaxies, and you're just getting the wrong host some fraction of the time, it's just noise. Mm-hmm. Unless for some reason you're systematically picking something which goes a certain way. Like if you systematically only identify host galaxies which are close,
yeah.
Then you're going to have a bias. But as long as whatever you're doing in error is uniform in volume, it's fine.
So that's perfectly fine. But in terms of your estimates earlier, which
yes.
was before you were starting to
yes.
talk about systematics,
yes.
did you take into account that you would misidentify 1 out of every 10 volumes? So that, or were
yes.
you
yeah, no, we included the 90% factor. Yeah, that's
okay.
right. Yeah, so, you know, some fraction of the time you're just off. I mean, it's not in your population. So then you can think of it as it's just uninformative, right? I mean, you're picking a random galaxy, but it's uninformative. It's not the right galaxy.
Well, you're making an assumption that you've got something in the 90% range, and it isn't. So it's not necessarily
yeah,
just that it's uninformative. Your actual analysis of that event is wrong.
Yeah, but it okay,
it's
we can talk about
it.
It's as a, yeah, I mean, it doesn't introduce a system. It's like,
it's
know,
not a systematic, but
right.
so the statistical uncertainty that it introduces
it's just,
in your analysis.
That's right, because we use the fact that it's 90%. Yeah.
This kind of question I talk about, because you're using, you said, okay, I have these events, et cetera, perfect way from NordGL works, but I mean, the parameters of the event are measured with this detector, right?
So yeah.
Isn't it the cloud fighting is there? I mean, you're using the input parameters that you measure with this detector with the uncertainty that it has to measure the calibration of the
Yes, so that's right. But the input parameters are constrained by relativity. So you can say, oh, here's the best fit input parameters, but then they tell you H of T, if you like. And now you have a full waveform and you can check whether, for example, at early, you know, at low frequency versus high frequency, does the relative H of T make sense? And that's now fixed. So it's, we're using the data. I mean, it's the same thing as, I mean, we can talk about, so let's, can you constrain relativity, GR, using 1708, or using any detection with LIGO Virgo?
I mean, you can set it the other way around, right? What you normally do is you calibrate the detector so you know what displacement gives you straight. Any error in that, so the easiest error to make is measuring the arm length. Let's say you measure 4.1 kilometers instead of 4 kilometers, you're taking 4 kilometer long arms. All your amplitudes will be off, right, by that factor. And so your measured luminosity distances will be off. And so your measurement of the Hubble constant, when you compare the luminosity distance to the redshift distance, will be off, right? So you go the other way around, you say, okay, Reese has measured the Hubble constant, so then I will have that as my known, and then go back to the detector calibration as my unknown.
So you're measuring 4 kilometers starting with the 40 megaparsecs to the galaxy.
Yeah, that's one way to think about it. We've confirmed that the detector is what it says it is. I mean, that's amazing. It's a 30% using an astronomical
source. But it relies on the Hubble constant being known from other
instruments. It relies on the Hubble constant, to 5%.
Now, the question is, suppose that you find, you measure the Hubble constant and you find the discrepancy with, well, any of the other measurements. Let's say, suppose that there is only one measurement, right? It's technically supernova.
Yeah.
And now you find a measurement with gravitational wave, which is off.
Yeah.
So it doesn't mean that you can't really tell whether you have, just your instrument that is miscalibrated, because if you recalibrate the instrument using the rise, that's a measurement, then you got a consistency.
So
does it mean that you cannot?
You can't do the astronomical calibration to calibrate specifically for H naught.
If you want to measure,
because you're measuring H naught,
well calibrated detector.
Yes.
Oh, right.
So if the goal is H naught, you can't use H naught to calibrate your detector. However, then you have to do these other calibrations, but there are multiple independent calibrations that people are talking about. So, you know, that stuff you do in the lab, you know, and it's all, you know, how well do you calibrate your photodiodes?
So how about that? Can you do it to 1%?
The claim is yes. Whether it's been demonstrated or not, it's not clear yet. But yes, there's the expectation is we can do it to better than 1%. And so there's a whole paper. It's called the Photon Calibrator (PCAL), where they kind of go through the steps to get there. And a lot of it depends on NIST measurements of properties of lasers and photodiodes, because that's what fundamentally limits your ability to calibrate.
So when people talk about 3G estimates of the Hubble constant,
yeah,
do we know that we're not going to be dominated by the regression at that time?
Yeah, so that's an issue. I know for LISA it's okay, because calibration for LISA is amazing. But for 3G, I don't know. And so it's, you know, it's something, I mean, I would claim we definitely want to get it to better than 1%, just to be safe. But beyond that, I don't know. The question is it worth getting to 0.1%? I don't know.
And there's another, you can ask the question a different way, which is by the time 3G happens, will the H0, you know, tension have been resolved?
And please let it, no, I
ELT,
the idea that we'd still be talking about H naught. Anyway, that's it.
I mean, because if by, you know, 2040, when you do 3G science runs, we have H0 confidently, then you can use H0 as input to do interesting astrophysics
with
gravitational waves. You're not trying to use gravitational waves to measure H0 anymore. You can go the other way and say, I know H0, so I can get.
But my claim would be. The LVC will give you H0. Yeah, I mean, just LIGO Virgo will give you H0 to, better than a percent by then easily, unless something dramatic happens.
Is there other physics that cares about the calibration to 1%?
Yes, particularly the high frequency calibration. Yeah. If you want to get the time
equation of state.
You need a good high frequency calibration as well as. Just because there's amplitude calibration and frequency calibration. If you look at the calibration certainty papers from O1 and O2, they basically give you envelopes of calibration uncertainty and amplitude. Delta amplitude is a function of frequency, and delta phase is a function of frequency. And so the calibration team worries about both, because screwing up the phase calibration is going to screw up measurements and probabilities of the signal.
And this constrains both, for what it's worth, as well.
And the LIGO results right now are marginalized over those calibration envelopes.
So there's some standard number, like some number of degrees, or
suppose it actually doesn't matter if you don't marginalize the basic error, because still which demonstrates you're dominated by the statistical and the systematic calibration.
Testing
triage
is going to be affected.
Yes.
So if you had to bet, once we have a good measurement of H0, it'll be consistent with.
All right. You see this thing? No way. But come in 2 weeks. I'm sure you can form your own thing.
So let's say we have the measurement of H0 and we resolve the tension. What is the main cosmological physics that we actually use? We'll be able to pull out that. It doesn't matter whether it is agrees with CMB
Doesn't it kind of like, won't we learn different things if it comes
down on the So, the most likely is if we get, supernova or CMB, one or the other, we're going to learn about systematics and, what's going on and that.
Dark energy, I guess that's what we're getting.
But assuming that it gets resolved and they're, here's what we got, and now we really have a very firm measurement of better than a percent from, standard sirens, then you can combine that with CMB and you get, some information about dark energy. And, ideally you would want to get even, some evidence for evolution in the BNS population. I think that would be very hard, but for the next generation, then that all comes for free. And so now you get to really constrain properties of the dark energy nearby in the regime of interest out to redshift of a half or one. But even just having H0 combined with CMB gives you a measurement of equation of state. And so it's there are little H's everywhere in this business, and so just getting that out is extremely useful. So that's the first thing. But then, after that, then it's mostly the sorts of stuff I was talking about before. Now you've just kind of narrowed down. So now if you want to know about redshift evolution or any of these other things, you just don't have this uncertainty anymore.
Any more questions or discussion?
Oh my God, I'm only 4 minutes early.
Okay, let's thank Daniel again.